Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our subject today, the simply titled Star Trek, which opened this weekend. We're going to be speaking with Roger Guyette, who is the VFX supervisor from ILM on the film. Now, the film opened up to $72.5 million this weekend, and I donated my money as well, enjoyed the film quite a bit, actually. Loved the look of the film, kind of liked some of the playing on the old stuff and the new. The look of the anamorphic lens, maybe not so much on the number of lens flares, but hey, I guess that's a personal preference. But $72.5 million is about half of the projected $150 million budget, and that handily trounced the last couple films, Star Trek Insurrection and Nemesis. If you take a look back to the early 80s, actually, the Wrath of Khan had an entire budget of $12 million initially, and the first weekend actually grossed $14 million. And several of the films after it actually came really close to meeting the budget in the first weekend. Now, I think this film and the way they're making films with all the visual effects nowadays, I think it's going to have the legs to make that back over time. So really an impressive weekend opening, and nice to see, as they've been saying, the series rebooted apparently quite successfully. Now, the podcast this week is fantastic. I want to point out also, though, that we have great FX Guy TV up on the site. It's got director J.J. Abrams speaking with Mike Seymour, as well as a conversation with the actor Carl Urban. So that's a good one as well if you haven't checked that out. Back to this podcast, really some great stuff in it. Walking through a whole lot of issues, things like the anamorphic lens that I mentioned earlier. Quite interesting on Roger's opinion of why that's such a great lens to use and why he was willing to go through the extra effort and the kind of post issues that you have to deal with when you're working with anamorphic lenses, and why he was willing to do that. Really fascinating discussion. Actually, Guyette worked with Abrams on MI3 and some interesting tidbits from that, as well as kind of some work that actually J.J. Abrams did actually on some of the scenes in the film and why he got a VFX credit in that film. And also just interesting stuff like shooting an ice planet in the drill platform actually over at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, where the baseball Dodgers play. So interesting stuff. It's about 50 minutes long, chock full of good stuff. So why don't we go ahead and join that interview now. Mike Seymour speaking with Roger Guyette from ILM.
So Roger, thank you so much for joining us. I just, on this film, you actually worked as second unit director as well as a visual effects supervisor. And I was just wondering how you found that. Had you done a lot of second unit directing before?
Well, over the years, you know, working as a visual effects supervisor, what happens is you inevitably end up shooting elements, and I guess that's your first, you know, you dip into that world by, you know, shooting elements and different pieces of movies and working as a, you know, splinter unit or something like that. And then inevitably you spend a lot of time, you know, with second unit directors and really, you know, people like Peter MacDonald on the Harry Potter movies, and Vic Armstrong, you know, I've worked with those guys who really are great second unit directors, and there's certainly an art to it, because second unit directing is more about the, you know, the action sequences. And inevitably you end up, you know, shooting a lot of the pieces of the, you know, the visual effects stuff. So it's a sort of, there's a sort of a logical step there, I think, to start doing that kind of thing.
But the difference, I guess, between that step of shooting elements and shooting as you did in this film is you really have to suddenly shift gear into working and being empathetic with the actors. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that actually, you know, that was the big jump for me. I mean, you've done, you know, you end up doing stuff with, you know, obviously with people, you know, who are, you know, if you're doing crowd replication or something like that, you inevitably end up directing some of those people. But suddenly, you know, I was actually directing on occasion sometimes some of the principals, or you're doing a shot, you know, I think one of the first shots we did was, you know, Zoe, who plays Uhura, you know, running down a corridor, and suddenly, you know, that comes into the, you know, into the equation about how you deal with them. And I have to say, you know, deeply indebted to JJ, because, you know, there's a degree of trust there that you're not going to screw this up, and you're going to treat them with the right kind of respect, and, you know what you're doing, and he knew that it was the first time that I'd sort of officially done it. So there was a little bit of a learning curve on that, and obviously you see other people do it and you think you can do it, but there's nothing like actually doing it yourself, you know.
It's funny, isn't it? Like you can direct sort of extras on a green screen, which are just going to be in crowd replication, and it's one level, but
yeah,
getting a performance from a principal cast member, I think it almost should be compulsory if somehow you could do it for all visual effects people, because I think it elevates your opinion of the skill of the actor to actually,
Yeah, you totally, you know, you're being asked different questions. And don't get me wrong, I mean, it's not like we shot a lot of the stuff with, you know, the principals, but you do enough, and certainly enough with sort of secondary act, you know, the sort of secondary actors in the movie, you know, that you learn a lot about that, you know. So I loved it, you know. I mean, the great thing for me is I've been doing this for a while, so I felt confident about all the technical aspects of what we were doing, and you know, and I've. You know, JJ and I had done a movie before together, Mission Impossible, which just meant that we had a certain, you know, we had a relationship, and there was a degree of trust there, and there's a sort of shorthand in the way that we communicate with each other. So, you know, it was a great experience for me, and I had a lot of fun.
He's actually quite, contrary to some of the press, he's actually quite enthusiastic about visual effects, isn't it, in terms of storytelling?
Oh, incredibly so. I mean, the one thing that you learn very quickly about JJ is that, you know, having a background as a writer and someone that wants to tell, you know, real stories and make real movies about stories and about people, is that he has, besides having, you know, sort of incredible amount of sort of creative energy, the guy is firmly rooted in the idea that, you know, you're telling a story, and so everything has to kind of serve that purpose. And it's interesting that at the same time he realizes that actually visual effects is just it's a tool, and it's part of a filmmaking. If you're trying to make a movie like Star Trek, you can't do it without visual effects. And what he doesn't do is just sort of say, okay, you know, you go and do your thing, and you know, we'll hopefully you'll kind of get it right, you know, and figure that out. He sort of embraces all of that stuff and uses it as a storytelling tool, which is the, you know, what it is. It's just part of the movie. It's just another tool for a filmmaker. And he just really embraces it. And obviously it just doesn't hurt that he actually is interested in, you know, how things are done. And that just makes my job easier, because he wants to talk about some of that stuff. And for the most part, when you're making a movie like Star Trek, it's incredibly complicated, quite frankly, and it requires a lot of planning. And that means that you have to sit down with people and engage them and talk to them about what they're really trying to do as a storyteller and as a filmmaker, and try and figure out, okay, you know, what's our approach going to be, and what are you trying to get out of this as a director? And the fact that he's just interested in it just makes that whole process a lot easier.
In fact, you found that out firsthand on Mission Impossible, right?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, Mission Impossible, we did. I mean, the other thing that's always fun to me is that he has a great interest in magic and sort of sleight of hand. And he knows that to a certain extent, sometimes, I mean, film is kind of an illusion, obviously, you know, all these things aren't really happening. So
they're not really in space. You
know,
yes.
Yeah, we're not really out in space, and we're not, you know, Ethan Hunt isn't going around, you know, swinging from rooftops in Shanghai and, you know, in Mission Impossible. And so he likes that kind of sleight of hand. So it's fun, you know, talking to him about how we can actually try and achieve something, and actually when it's seen visually, how it will be perceived. And, you know, certainly on Mission Impossible, we really got kind of our feet wet in terms of the planning by, you know, we did the whole bridge sequence in a field, you know.
Yeah.
And that was that was the sequence where, you know, Ethan Hunt's running around on the bridge, and you know, they've got some hostages, and you know, they end up being attacked by these pilotless plane that's firing these missiles and all this sort of stuff. And we just shot it in a field, and it's supposed to be, you know, in Chesapeake Bay, you know. And he sort of really loved that and embraced that kind of sort of approach to something, because in the movie, you know, it looks like you're in Chesapeake Bay, but you know, in reality, you're in a field just outside of LA. So he sort of takes that on board, and it's a lot of, you know, he's a fun guy to actually work with. He really is. You always coming to work with a lot of heart, you know, a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm, and those are the kind of people you want to work with, because it's long hours, you know.
Did you mention to me before he actually did some work on Mission Impossible 2?
He did, yeah, he did. There's a sequence in the movie where, you know, they planted a small, explosive device in someone's head, and as you would do if you were, spy.
Well, obviously, yeah.
Whatever. Yeah, of course you would. And they're on a helicopter, and Tom Cruise character is talking to the lady who's got this bomb in her head, and then the thing explodes, and JJ kind of did two versions of the scene. One where you had blood splatter coming off the explosion. So there's obviously, a classic shot, Ethan Hunt looking down at the girl, and then splat, the blood goes on his face. Well, when you do something like that, you're suddenly, and splattering blood is a big thing for the
ratings board?
The rating, the rating you're going to get on the movie. And suddenly that made a difference. And so one of the things they decided to do was do the non-splatted version. And, of course, what happened was he really liked Tom's performance in the splattered version. And so he said, okay, I'm going to, as a sort of price of, the sins of my, not shooting that twice or whatever, I'll paint the blood out, rather than getting us, our guys to do it. So he sat down and he had to go at painting the blood out, and of course you realize that it's a lot harder to do than you would perceive it to be. And so he ended up getting some tutelage from a lady here, Beth D'Amato, who's the head of the paint department, and they became firm friends, and he learned a lot about how that kind of work is achieved, and he ended up getting a credit for the visual effects.
It's funny, isn't it? It's kind of a useful lesson. While something may be achievable, we will say that it's easy because it's achievable easy. It doesn't necessarily mean it's easy in terms of the workload to do it.
No, and I think, there's definitely, the kind of, to be honest, there is that kind of fix it in post, kind of mentality about a lot of films that get made these days. And that's something, again, that, JJ, if you understand, and that's okay to say fix it in post, as long as you actually understand what's going to really happen. And is that the version that you really want in the movie? And there's an economics to it all, quite frankly, and obviously shooting movies is extremely expensive, and sometimes now it's easier just to turn around and go, okay, well, we'll try and figure out, we'll paint that plane out of the sky later, and more often than not, it really makes sense. But sometimes, if you're dealing with actors, and you want them to react to something, and sometimes it's better to actually have it there, and you might actually get a different kind of performance out of that actor. So he's very much of the school that, if you can build something and it represents a drill platform or a room or a place, is there a location that we can find that will serve that purpose so that the actors and the whole space sort of is real and tactile and there,
And so just swinging around to Trek for a second, you guys are in a quite unusual position. I'd almost point out that it's unprecedented of having actually two films that have gone through ILM recently that weren't delivered 2 seconds before they went to cinemas. I'm referring to the new Harry Potter and to this one, which, I mean, we're talking about Star Trek now, but in fact you finished work on it last year, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was that. That was actually kind of an interesting process. I mean, I don't know the full backstory on all the reasons that happened, but the version that I heard was that, I mean, any studio that's going to make a movie that's based upon a franchise, despite the script or despite who's involved with it, you're going to get some preconceptions about what kind of movie you're going to make, and JJ certainly wasn't going to make a movie that was sort of to some extent he's making his own version of a Star Trek movie without a doubt, and I think people didn't quite realize what was going on until, I think, about a month or so in, and we had a hiatus because it was Christmas time, and he put together a reel and started, some of the executives saw some of the reels, and they were going, I think they did a bit of an, oh my God, this is really amazing. And
when you say Christmas, that was the Christmas a year and a half ago, correct?
Yeah, like. It was. Christmas 2007. Yeah, right. Christmas 2007. Because we started, I still remember we started shooting on, you know, if you're English, you remember these things, because it was Guy Fawkes Day. You know, it was the 5th of November, and I think we started shooting 5th of November 2007, and then we had a break over the Christmas period, and it was also the time of the writer's strike, which was a, you know, an interesting time to be trying to make a movie, but especially for somebody that, you know, has a background as a writer. But, you know, and he put this reel together, and some of the marketing guys saw it, and a lot of the Paramount executives saw it, and we were going to release December 2008, and suddenly we're releasing, you know, summer 2009. Because once they'd seen it, they just realized that it wasn't the movie, you know, that they were imagining in their heads, and suddenly they had this incredibly energetic action adventure story, and you know,
but character driven, which is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
The holy grail, a character driven action film that happens to be sci-fi.
And I think suddenly, you know, you get a completely different feel off it. You know, it wasn't for just a fan based movie, and it was, as you say, it's. I think it's really well written and wonderfully acted by all those guys, and it's a great movie, and suddenly, you know, you have something like that, and you go, okay, this has got a completely different kind of audience than they imagined, and suddenly it's a summer release, you know, and they thought that they could really push it a bit harder in the summertime. So I was very pleased at that, because I said to JJ, he looked at me and he said, I guess we're releasing in the summer, and I said, well, there's a complete and utter endorsement, you know, from the studio as to what we're doing, you know.
I mean, from a financial side, that's a huge amount of money they're carrying for another 6 months. But I guess my job, I've been lucky enough to talk to a lot of visual effects supervisors, and I think if I'd asked this, you know, to others in the past, the attitude would have been, well, we'll use all the available time you have because we never have enough time. And I'm kind of surprised that you actually wrapped the film because you actually finished your effects when you were meant to, right?
Well, we did and we didn't. I mean, what really happened was, I mean, Star Trek is not done on a, you know, just on an enormous budget, and it is, you know, it there are financial limits to, you know, I mean, just the economics of it all. And the thing about a movie is actually keeping a movie open in post, you're burning a lot of money every week. And so what we decided to do, and what the studio really wanted us to do, was to try and hit, you know, a date that was fairly close to the original date, because it was just, I mean, that was just a purely financial thing. And that was for everybody. That wasn't just us. That was just the whole post process. And the original concept, of course, was, you know, you finish the movie and it, you know, it's going to sit on a shelf. Well, clearly that isn't going to happen because, you know, JJ's far too creative and has way too many ideas. So, you know, what really happened was we got pretty close to finishing it. And then over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, you know, smaller changes have been happening. But I think from his perspective as a filmmaker, what's interesting is that he was able to actually go back and make small changes to it that I think have had, you know, made a bigger, you know, in other words, it's like making a 1% change has given you a better return in terms of or a bigger impact,
are we effectively seeing the director's cut, therefore, the version that you normally see after, because somebody's had a chance to ponder and go back and revisit?
I mean, that was the really interesting thing to me, was that, you know, we delivered all the shots. I mean, he re-edited the order of some of the visual effects stuff we did, you know, some of that move changed around, blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, what it really did was that it gave him a time where, you know, he could just reflect on the movie he'd made and make, you know, smaller adjustments to it. And they weren't big changes, but I think they definitely, you know, they definitely improved the movie. And it's
Can you give us an example of one of those things that happened after it?
Well, I think some of those things were, you know, I mean, you know, I tend to remember sort of silly things that, you know, don't count for very much, but just stuff where, I mean, one thing about this movie is, because it's a time travel movie, you end up with this really kind of complicated kind of sense of continuity. So one thing, you know, was that, you know, like, for example, a silly thing was that Nero is the bad guy. At different points in the movie, he doesn't have this lump taken out of his ear because it was something that happened in jail. So there was this sort of timeline there where, and there were a couple of moments where JJ reorganized stuff, and then he needed to go back and remove the piece of the ear, you know.
Right.
And some of those things were, you know, it sounds trivial, but you know, some of these shots were playing back on a monitor screen inside, you know. So there were these funny little moments where, you know, you got to see the movie and go, okay, well, actually, now in the timeline, if you shift that, it means that we need to lose part of his ear, you know. So we'd go back and lop off part of his ear, and stuff like that, and then just stuff where you could say, for example, if you've got two moments and you're sort of cross-cutting between the two moments, you could also just play out the moment on one character and play out the moment on the other character. And I think when JJ went back and, you know, reflected on the third act of the movie, he thought it was better to hold on Kirk or his moment longer instead of cross-cutting so much. So he held on to some of those things longer when he went back and watched it again. But it's very, what tends to happen is you get this kind of tunnel vision on these kind of things, and it's hard to be completely objective because you're so involved in it. And it was really interesting for me. You know, I did most of my work. I remember we broke for Christmas. I mean, now I'm talking 2008. 2009, we were doing Little Odds and Ends. You know, I went back and I watched the movie in February or something like that. And suddenly I hadn't watched the movie for about a month. And suddenly you see it in a different light. You know, you just don't have all this baggage with you.
And yet at the height of your production, you threw ILM's, or almost all of ILM's, very talented staff behind pulling this off. It was,
yeah.
It wasn't on a skeleton staff. It was, I mean, what, you had about, what, 400 people at one stage?
Yeah, I mean, no, we had hundreds of people. And that's what it takes to make these kinds of movies. It was a fairly... I mean, it was, I guess it's a sort of an imposed, financially imposed sort of short schedule. I mean, normally that deadline, as you said, you know, you would hit that deadline, the movie would come out. In our case, a lot of it was to do with the finances. The budget of Star Trek is not, you know, it's not a bottomless checkbook. Does that mean anything? Or
absolutely. Totally. Yeah. And of course... you know, it's harder to be successful if you run the budget right up through the roof, even though obviously it was a substantial budget. And so you guys had about 750 or three quarters of the shots? Well, there was about 1,000, was there?
Well, we did, yeah. I mean, ILM did about 800 or so shots. And then we had Digital Domain did about 150. And then, you know, you've got companies like Lola, you know, did quite a lot of work on the show too. They did The Green Girl, you know, the classic stuff that they're becoming well known for, you know, the makeup effects.
Mm.
And then, you know, we also had a company called Svengali came in with Stefano Trevelli as their supervisor, and he did, you know, they did 100 or so shots. So, you know, and you tend to forget the numbers very quickly, but, you know, the runtime in the movie is more than an hour's worth of visual effects in the movie, you know, and it's a two-hour movie. And it probably... It's, you know, when I go back and sort of look at the work we did, we were always doing the kind of bigger stuff because generally JJ built sets, so we weren't doing kind of trivial set extensions or funny blue screens where we, you know, and all that sort mm-hmm. of stuff. We were doing a lot of bigger stuff, you know, and, you know, we did well over 1,000 shots, and it's one of those things where, but the shots you're doing are actually the difficult shots, you know. You're doing
shot count alone doesn't give you very much.
Yeah.
One shot is. And you had.
When the shot is trivial.
And at ILM, you're working presumably very closely with Russell Earl.
Oh yeah, I mean Russell. Yeah, I mean obviously I work for ILM. Russell works for ILM. I mean the way that it worked is JJ sort of is basically his model is slightly different than others in the sense that although I'm working for ILM, I oversee all the effects for the movie, and that's a slightly unusual model. But in this day and age, in the visual effects world, everyone has a way of working, and there's no rules anymore. And it's just a much more, a more open environment, and you've got to trust that everyone is basically just trying to make the movie as the best they can. So you have a slightly odd thing happens as you end up supervising work at Digital Domain. Or something like that, you know. But to be honest with you, everyone on board is trying to make the best movie they can. So it's, you know, Kelly Port was their supervisor and did a great job and did a sequence, you know, a couple of different sequences. Main, you know, they did the a sequence with Scotty in the engineering bay. I mean, that was the biggest thing they did. But, you know, the main thing is that, you know, everyone's sort of just trying to make the movie as cool as possible. And I think that's the interesting thing about visual effects, is that ultimately everyone who works in this business is just incredibly passionate about it, you know?
Yeah, I remember hearing, I think it was Tom Hanks. No, sorry, it wasn't. It was Ron Howard saying that when you go on set, you have to remember that everyone's basically there as intelligent, dedicated, enthusiastic filmmakers, and that's the premise that you come to. Everybody comes to it as that, you know. That
yeah,
level.
Yeah.
Hey, can I ask you some of the tech stuff? Because I'd like to get into some of the tech stuff, and not least of which is because there are some really interesting visuals in the film. I'm not going to go into a lot of depth on the ships, though. They were very impressive. I would like to discuss the imploding planet because, you know, that's quite a, you know, and planet explodes is kind of a...
yeah, the one line in the script kind of thing.
Yeah, and that was, that was something that could have looked, you know, 50 different ways. It could have looked like the Death Star blowing out. You know, yeah. It's intended to implode. But I guess the starting point was, how long did it take you to get to what you wanted it to look like? And then once you knew what it wanted to look like, how hard was it to do that?
Well, I mean, all of those things, I was just talking to somebody this morning, and I said, you know, there is no shortcut. When something looks really complicated, generally it is, you know, and it's hard to do. And those sort of shots, you know, the planet implodes, essentially it was always going to be tough, and it was tough. And, you know, we got some really cool people working on the show, and David Weitzberg was actually the guy that sort of did a lot of the work on that particular shot where, you know, the actual planet does implode. And
David had a team of like 13 people or something, didn't he, working with him doing that?
Yeah, I mean, there was a big group of people working on it. And, you know, I mean, that, you know, I remember, you know, Ben O'Brien did a lot of the compositing and people like that. It's an enormous team effort. And, you know, when you have shots like that, you know, sometimes it's actually hard to feel like you're making sort of forward momentum because there are so many different disciplines involved in that process of just doing something like that. And, you know, they're all trying to coordinate all of their efforts. And each of those things takes a while to run, you know. And obviously we approach a lot of that. I mean, we have a lot of proprietary software and we have a lot of very smart people here who are able to, you know, help us out with a lot of programming stuff. And we have this program called Fracture, which, you know, we talked more, you mentioned earlier. And basically what you're doing is you're running a simulation, and it's sort of a directed simulation in the larger scale of events, you know, in the larger, if you like, the larger scale pieces are doing this sort of directed simulation. And what's happening there is, you know, they're colliding based upon physics, and they're hitting each other and then breaking apart. And then depending on the kind of the mass that they have and the kind of material that they're supposed to be, you know, from, you know, obviously a lump of earth is going to react more differently than a lump of rock as opposed to a piece of steel. So they're all trying to obey, you know, behavior that's based upon their own properties. And obviously you can, you know, there's a lot of programs out there that sort of do this kind of thing, but more often than not, we're doing it on this kind of very colossal scale, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, it was a real sort of challenge to sell the scale that it didn't look like a, you know, a smaller thing.
And that was, you know, that's a hard part of it. You know, anything you're doing is that more often than not, the shot has kind of different things that pull you in different directions. You know, you want it to have mass, so it's slow, but at the same time, you have to show the whole planet disappearing. Yeah, you end up in this kind of weird place where you're just trying to find the right kind of path through all of this process. And but the shot itself, you know, the design of the whole planet exploding was relatively simple. We ended up running into all sorts of issues with timing, and what often happens with these kinds of things is that, you know, you run the simulation itself takes a long time to run, then you're trying to render that simulation, and then the compositor's actually compositing something that was rendered, you know, two versions ago, because that's the only version that's rendered. So you end up in this kind of weird kind of catch-up mode, and that's true of virtually any complicated shot. So you're sort of adjusting, you're seeing something which is already old by the time you're seeing it, and that's just part of the process of doing these big shots, you know. But I'd say that certainly ILM just has some amazing tools when it comes to trashing stuff, which we did a lot of in the movie, you know.
And if that was like a fully sort of CG solution, which obviously still, I think you're compositing. You did Shake compositing mainly on this, was it? You were saying?
Yeah, we did a lot of work in Shake on the movie, yeah.
But notwithstanding that, it's a CG fundamentally shot, so you've got a blank canvas. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the other sort of work that you did, such as on Delta Vega, because there you had the problem that you'd shot this literally on a car park kind of lot at Dodger Stadium, and you had to combine live action and CG, and it was, you know, I think you were using Xeno on that, were you?
Yeah, I mean, Xeno is a tool that, you know, ILM uses, and it's sort of like the hub, you know, the main program. It's like a hub, if you like, and there's a lighting tool and match moving tools and all sorts of tools within the world of Xeno, and it really allows you to sort of customize different elements of it. And certainly one of the first, you know, years ago when it first came about, we started doing a lot of stuff that, you know, now is much more commonplace, where you're doing camera projections and you could do them fully in, you know, and use dimensions. So in other words, you were projecting a photograph of, you know, a block of ice onto a simple piece of geometry. And you can obviously see that straight away, by taking a photograph, you've gained a lot in terms of the visual level that you've suddenly managed to obtain. But sometimes, obviously, that doesn't necessarily give you all the answers because of the perspective of everything. But it starts joining together all these different elements. Like, you can take a photograph of something and put it with a, you know, suddenly give it dimension by seeing the camera move and, you know, project it onto a simple piece of geometry and just sort of like visual tricks like that. But the reason I mention that is because part of the process of doing the Ice Planet was that JJ and I and Dan Mindell, the DP, have got very strong opinions about how things should be photographed and the kind of light that they should be in. And I'd still argue that, you know, if you want something to appear to be, you know, in an exterior world, you know, in a lit, for example, you know, you know, outside, basically, then more often than not, that's something that actually for a DP, you know, you see there's something funny when something like that shot in indoors, and it's really hard to generate the same kind of lighting environment in on a set. And we had these two moments in the movie, two very substantial sequences. One was Delta Vega and Ice Planet, and one was on Vulcan, where these guys are what we call space jumping down to this drill platform. And we wanted to shoot them both outside, and we just were trying to come up with a way of doing it that would work, because they were both, one was in ice and one was in full sun. And it's kind of like, how do you make that work? And actually, it became this thing where I said to JJ, maybe somewhat boldly, that we should do them both outside, and maybe there was a chance that there was a piece that we could do the same kind of trick that we did on Mission Impossible. We could find a piece of ground where we had a very low horizon. In other words, you know, for example, if you were on a cliff looking at the ocean or something like that. So I went off on a scouting trip with the location manager, and everything we looked at didn't seem quite right. And then she said, well, there's this raised car park at Dodger Stadium. And so we went there, and it seemed kind of almost, I thought, okay, I think we can make this work. And I took some photographs, and I went back to JJ, and I showed him this sort of diorama of images. And he went, is this really going to work? And I was like, did the old 100%. Yeah, of course it will. And inside, I thought, Jesus, you know.
I mean, no offense, you know, or anything, but putting an ice planet on the top of Dodger Stadium car park in the middle of Los Angeles, it's not known for its Arctic conditions.
I mean, it does sound mad. And then we had to come up with this other scheme where we silked over the ice planet, so that got diffuse light, and we let the drill be in full sun. And actually, it worked out so well. And Tommy Gormley, the AD, came up with this great plan where JJ was shooting on one set, I would shoot on the other, and actually it just really worked out so well. And it sounds absolutely mad, you know, when you think about it. But when you watch the movie, you just think, God, you know, one of these sequences is like full sun and completely exterior. The other one is completely overcast, and they're both done on these very limited sets. But the great thing about them, ultimately to me, is that they're both photographed in natural light, and that was the thing that I always felt very strongly about.
I think actually, that really shows, especially on the jump platform. I mean, obviously, yeah, the quality of light in the snowy environment perhaps was less, because it obviously
yeah,
less scrimmed.
But it
was completely apparent to me. I got to see those two or three reels that were shown months ago, that was included in that preview. And it just stuck out to me in a good way as to being, hang on a second, this has got to be green screen or heavy roto, but this just doesn't look studio at all. And when I saw it in the final film, the same thing. Yeah, it just works so well for not being a sort of set piece, studio piece. And I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. I think it was the light that did it. And I think also you didn't fuss with it too much, but it was a pretty complicated action sequence.
It's incredibly complicated. I mean, you're going from, you know, I mean, we did, you know, from a, you know, from the stuff that, I mean, technically photographing all of those pieces, you know, I mean, JJ did a lot of the you know, all the character stuff, and then I shot all the action on both Delta Vega and the jump platform, and to a certain extent, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I was very familiar with, and also able to, you know, at the same time use both, you know, the visual effects background, and just as a second unit turret, and making choices about what we thought we could do and what would work best. And
jump platform must have ended up being a huge part of the film's visual effects, statistically.
Oh, yeah. There's well over 100 shots in that sequence, and, you know, that sequence alone has just got every different kind of combination of thing going on, you know, where you're going from full CG to, you know, live action people, sometimes photographed at night, sometimes during the day. It's just a mad combination of stuff. And, you know, when you arrive on the platform, you know, sometimes, you know, there were even a couple of moments that we were almost able to do completely in camera. And then, you know, because of the way that the horizon worked, because we had this very small set. So it's just this really wild kind of jumble of stuff. And that's where, you know, when you sit down and you know, we tend to, you know, as a crew, the most efficient thing you can do is when everyone understands what you're trying to achieve. And the only way you can do that is by having meetings and talking about what you're going to do. And, you know, so we became a little famous for our lunchtime meetings on the show, where JJ and I and Dan Mindel and, you know, Tommy Gormley and those guys and the grips would meet, and we'd talk about, okay, we're going to do this. This is going to be Scott Shambliss, the production designer, would say, okay, how much do I need to build? Well, you need to build, let's say, 60 feet of ice planet, you know, we put these cargo containers up and with a blue screen on the back, and then that the cargo containers actually added a sort of level of safety to this huge 200-foot silk that we hung over the set. So just a massive planning, and, you know, different shots require different things. And then you go off and shoot plates. You know, we shot plates for both sequences, actually, some in Utah, and then we went to Alaska and shot a whole bunch of stuff in Alaska for the ice planet. But, you know, ultimately, it's a lot of fun. And actually, as a visual effects supervisor, when you see the benefits of actually planning that stuff out and it comes together, and then you watch the finished sequence in the movie and you go, yeah, you know, that's exactly what I wanted it to be, you know?
Let me ask you a question about that, because you were shooting on anamorphic lenses, and obviously for 100% live action stuff in a set, we know that JJ was, you know, or the DOP was shoving torches down to get flares and give that lovely glaring look. But when you're shooting the effects sequences and the action sequences, I imagine that it would be a temptation to not want to have any glares in there, just so that you can get in and underneath them to do keying and roto and stuff.
And that's something that I think, you know, I don't think any visual effects supervisor will ever, be able to give you an absolutely, you know, it's kind of the voodoo of the job, is that sometimes, you know, I mean, the hard part is when you're shooting with multiple cameras, you know, and you want different things really to be happening on the different cameras, you know, like, why don't we try and do this with smoke, but the other camera's seeing off the set, so maybe smoke's not such a good thing, and, okay, we'll flare on this camera, but not on, you know, it's you end up in this situation where you're just constantly trying to juggle all these different pieces, and certainly on Trek, you know, straight off the bat, I knew that, you know, JJ originally said, okay, well, we could be considering shooting this digital. And you know, we had about a 10-second conversation, and then, you know, we were back on the anamorphic world because both JJ loves that, you know, Dan, the DP, loves that. I love it, you know. So ultimately, it's more work for a visual effects company to do an anamorphic movie because the beauty of those lenses is they're essentially handmade, and because they're trying to do something that's not, it's not, you know, it's got sort of an organic quality to it, and it has imperfection, and that's kind of the beauty of it, but at the same time, that just makes it harder to do visual effects. And what I mean by that is if you actually look at the way the lens is behaving, it's actually distorting, and the distortion is not a linear thing across the lens, it's fairly, well, I use the word arbitrary. So if you just took a grid and you photographed the grid, that would clue you into the way that the lens was distorting. But what's interesting and what makes it even harder is, you know, as you rack focus, the distortion changes too. So, okay, why is that difficult? Well, imagine you have something where you're trying to, if you have half a drill platform and you're trying to glue on the other half of the drill platform, then obviously as the image distorts and as you pan across the real object, then it distorts, and it distorts in different ways, and you have to seamlessly blend your piece back into that. And obviously if it doesn't follow the same contours of the distortion, then it's going to look off and it's going to not fit. And so therein lies the rub. But to me, the kind of the ultimate result and the overall, you know, the look of an anamorphic movie, you know, is something that I think intrinsically just looks more interesting and much more filmic.
I couldn't agree more. But how did you kind of solve that distortion thing? Because I know the actual flares themselves, you developed the Sunspot program to kind of simulate the flares.
What we did different things. One is that if you have an anamorphic lens, you can put it through this. It's kind of like little mini exercise routine about the way that the lens behaves. So for each lens, we took each lens, and I can assure you there were a lot of them, and we put each of the lenses through its sort of paces and we just sort of analyze the way the lens behaves. And once you have that as a piece of data, then you can plug that back into our system, and then when you're working on your shot, you figure out what lens it was shot on, and therefore what the distortion is going to be and where the focus is and so on and so forth. But it's certainly not trivial. The other part of the issue is, yes, we do used a gratuitous, you know, lens flaring is kind of like part of the visual language of the movie. And what we did there was we developed a program that was, you know, Todd Vaziri here, who's very fascinated by lens flares. I took a whole bunch of anamorphic lenses, and we just shot a controlled series of tests, just seeing how different light sources flared the lens. And then we took that back as a bunch of elements. And Todd developed this program where, you know, we could add our own lens flares, and they would sort of seamlessly match the ones that were actually originated in the photography.
Yeah. I think that the understanding of lenses, like the real falling in love with the glass stuff, is that polish that pushes something from, you know, sort of believable to I love it. I loved the glary nature of the film, and I loved the, you know, that sort of sense of the action films that I kind of grew up with, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
I mean, and if you think, you know, anamorphic, you know, straight away, you know, you mention, you know, you talk about classic anamorphic movies, you know, whether, you know, I mean, obviously Lawrence of Arabia is like a 70mm type movie, but if you look at, you know,
I was going for classic, Die Hard.
yeah, or any of the, you know, movies like that where, you know, they have this tremendous scope, and, you know, the scope of those movies is something that, you know, you want to be widescreen in a movie like this because you're going to places, you're seeing people in these sort of slightly strange environments or whatever, you know, and it's every choice that you're making, especially when with JJ, and that was something that, you know, you learn very quickly with JJ, is it's not arbitrary. You know, all of these decisions are made for a reason, you know, and he's certainly more, you know, smart enough that he could talk about any aspect of the movie and explain to you why it is the way it is. And, you know, that process just makes you think really hard about what you're doing and why you're doing it and to have a reason. But to me, you know, you think about Anamorphic, you think about scope. I think the movie has tremendous scope. That's something that he really injected into the movie, was just this idea that these people, you know, it's a movie of discovery and adventure, you know. And just being wide, you know, essentially widescreen, just means that you get to take in everything that's around you, you know?
Yeah, no, I think, and look, it works so well cinematically. Of course, it works very well as a story and as an action piece. And quite frankly, I just had fun. Like, I just found myself smiling in sequences and rooting for the guys.
You know,
and
it's got a lot of humor to it. I mean, one thing certainly from a visual effects standpoint that I'd say is that, you know, it's one of those kinds of movies where, you know, as JJ said, you know, you'd be doing a sequence about, you know, the guys, you know, on the ship or whatever, and then there'd be this other bit where, you know, obviously you can't go and shoot a plate. You know, it's, you know, you're out there in space and two ships are fighting or something, you know, or doing battle, and you, it's not like, you know, the best tool that you have is obviously previs to try and sort of figure out how that's going to go. But then as the movie progresses, you realize that, you know, you're trying to keep the flow of it. And obviously something that I was very conscious of was just trying to make sure that everything kind of felt continuous, you know, that when you suddenly jumped outside the ship, that suddenly you weren't watching a different movie, and that everything kind of had the same kind of quality to it and was photographed in a kind of similar way. And that, you know, those kinds of things are, you know, just, that's just part of my job, you know. But it's an interesting thing, and I think one thing that people may or may not appreciate is, you know, how do you go about making a movie like this, and maybe even from a visual effects standpoint, you know, I mean, I sat down and I watched, you know, the previous 10 movies, you know, and you it's one of those things where do you kind of do too much homework or do you not do enough, you know. And one thing that for me was reassuring was that I had people at ILM that knew all the details of the Star Trek world, and then so I didn't personally get too bogged down with trying to worry about the details of what I was doing. I sort of took a much more kind of visceral sort of approach where I sort of did my homework. I tried to learn from what they'd done in the past, you know, cinematically, looked at other movies that I liked, you know, like 2001, and, you know, I saw the recent Sunshine movie, you know, done by Danny Boyle, and those sort of things. And I sort of, in my head, I started putting together this kind of way that I wanted the movie to be, and, you know, talked to JJ about that, and, you know, and to a certain extent, you're just off and running and you're just doing it, you know. And then occasionally someone would say, well, actually, in the Star Trek world, this may happen, you know, or whatever, you know. And it's just an interesting approach. But to a certain extent, a lot of the stuff and a lot of the way that I create images is just, you know, I don't overwork or overcomplicate my process. I do my homework and then I just go and do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, and it becomes much more sort of, you know, I do a lot of drawings for people. I just say, okay, I think this should look something like this, and I'll just draw them a picture, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, it was a point we made when we were talking to Carl Urban, which was that his performance, which I think is exactly what I would feel about your special effects or visual effects, is that his performance was, you know, respectful to the original, but wasn't a caricature or a, you know, a sort of a parody of the original performance of his particular character, obviously as Bones.
Yeah.
And in the same way, I don't think we wanted you guys to just do a caricature or a repeat of what had been done before. We wanted something that was respectful to the original.
And I think anyone who's a fan of Trek, you know, and I'm a fan of Trek too, you know, but there's also a certain point where you just don't want it to be, you know, It needs a kind of, I don't know, maybe someone will argue with me actually, but, you know, to a certain extent, it needed a sort of a freshness to it. And if you'd just done, you know, can you imagine if we just copied the original Enterprise and put it in the movie? I think to a certain extent, maybe it would have just felt sort of somewhat campy and kind of retro, you know?
Yeah, totally.
You know, would it have felt contemporary? And to a certain extent, as JJ said, it's like one of those things where you think about the amount of computing power in your phone, you know, in relation to, you know, the kind of concepts they were talking about in the original movies or the original series, and, you know, the communicator, you know, and all those sort of things. There's a certain point where you go, okay, well, I mean, they have to be ergonomic and have to be devices that work, but, you know, you could probably, you know, you can keep on forever, you know, about the kind of technology, obviously, that would be available to them. But, you know, for me, it was just one of those things where I just wanted to, you know, you want to create the coolest thing possible and at the same time be respectful of what's gone on before you. And it's interesting as well, when you watch all the movies, you realize that, obviously, they'd adopted a kind of similar approach even in the first 10 movies, you know. You know, they've changed things. Oh, yeah, we decided to change the uniforms. And so when I started seeing that, I thought, okay, well, there's a certain license here to move things around a little bit, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, and also, quite frankly, sort of business terms, you can't make this film for just hardcore fans. It has to be a film that finds a wider audience The film can't afford to be made.
You know, again, you know, the thing that fascinates me is I think JJ's managed to find this incredible path through all of this where, you know, he's been very respectable to the history of the franchise, respectful to all the fans, done some great nods to stuff that people, you know, the Trek fans will recognize, you know, and at the same time make this thing just a great action adventure movie. And I think it's a lot of fun, but, you know, I really enjoyed working on the movie. Certainly, it presented all sorts of challenges for us, you know, both technically. But to me, a lot of the effort that I put into the movie is just making it look the way it does, you know, and the visual language of the movie and the way that, you know, I did different things where, you know, you look at the way that the sequences play out in time and the colors that you're bringing in and things like that. And that sounds, you know, to a certain extent, maybe a little pretentious, but there's a certain kind of sort of like the larger issues about, okay, Vulcan is sort of more in the red tone. So next time we go to a planet, I want it to be somewhat different than that, so that you have a sort of solid sense of the geography of space. However, you know, mad that might sound, I think it means that you can sort of do this kind of weird color map of the movie, you know?
Yeah, look, I think color is terribly important, especially for just an emotional scoring of, you know, where you are and what's going on.
Yeah. And you could talk forever, I think. I mean, certain people could talk forever about that. But the other interesting thing to me was just the darkness of the movie. I really wanted it to be dark, and I think it's got a nice amount, it's got a nice proportion of just darkness, and to me that sort of is sort of the equivalent of fear or something, you know.
Well, look, we really appreciate you taking time to talk to us. It's been a pleasure having a chat. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, you know, and I realized, you know, you know we finished working on this a while ago, but, you know, obviously it's a movie that is I'm immensely proud of, and we had such a fantastic crew working on the show, and I had a lot of fun with it. And I think for anyone who works in this business, you know, you can just keep on working on these kind of space movies and these kinds of movies. And actually, certainly something that I'd love to mention is just, I mean, Trek has this fantastic history and visual effects, just as the Star Wars movies do, or, you know, it just has this great kind of history of doing these different things, you know, weird holographic heads and, you know, particle systems. So it's great to be sort of associated with these things, this sort of lineage, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely some of the great moments of in the history of CG have popped up in, like you say, like the Genesis sequence and stuff that really were pivotal moments.
And some fantastic people have worked on this over time. I mean, it's certainly, you know, our version of it is, you know, in some ways, I wish if we, in different circumstances, maybe we would have built more models or something like that, because basically much the entire movie is done synthetically. But it's interesting now with the technology that's available. It's a way of working that obviously if you're very short of time, which we were, it's a much more it's a more versatile approach, and certainly with the advances in the way that shader models work and represent surfaces, I think it's something that's very successful.
Still, it's a shame not to have a giant model to be able to hang in the hallways of
Iron. Yeah, and that was something I loved about Mission. You know, we actually ended up with real models, and, you know, they'd make the plates of the helicopter, and at the end of it, you know, JJ ended up with pretty much a working helicopter, you know, that he could mess around with. But, you know, in a perfect world, I would have loved to have built parts of the Enterprise, but, you know, it wasn't to be this time, but next time.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. All right. Thank you.
Well, thanks for that so much, Roger. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed that conversation. I actually listened to it in the car over the weekend as I headed down south to visit my mom for Mother's Day. So really enjoyed that. Hope the time go by. As I mentioned before, be sure to check out the FX Guy TV episode where Mike Seymour speaks with director J.J. Abrams and, again, covers some of that stuff about the anamorphic lenses, which I thought was quite interesting as well. As you can see on the site, we're really back with a vengeance. I think Mike posted that on the FXPhD blog. We're knee-deep in production, or neck-deep in production, I'd say, on the Red Dwarf miniseries. But back now and trying to roll out new content to everyone with a lot of interesting stuff. We actually also enlisted the help of Bill Dawes, as well as Ian Fales, to help us write some of the stories for FX Guide. So thanks, guys, for that. It really truly is a team effort to get the stuff that we do at FX Guide out to you. Well, that's it for this week. As always, if you have any questions or comments, drop us a line at podcast@fxguide.com. Until next week, for my partners in crime, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.